Tommy Unger all in one, the legendary author and illustrator, Tommy Unger's first U.S. retrospective, first museum, U.S. museum retrospective. I'm very happy that Tommy is going to speak here today with Stephen Heller. Tommy, I think, needs no introduction. His work is all around us. And we are very pleased that Stephen, the renowned art director and writer, Stephen Heller, former art director of the New York Times Book Review and current chair of the design and entrepreneur program at SBA, has agreed to speak with Tommy today. So they're going to have a conversation, and then we will open things up to the audience. And following that, we will have an opportunity for book signing. So
I didn't expect how that goes.
You're going to get a lot of hand trouble. Carpal tunnel.
I'll have to find the energy, but happy people give me the energy.
So Stephen and Tom.
Well, thank you. First of all, I just want to say something about being here and being with Tommy, and that is, this is wonderful. This is my time in heaven. When I was just a kid, I knew Tommy's work very well from the Underground Sketchbook, which I spent a lot of time copying. And thanks to Tommy, I got thrown out of Hebrew school. Particularly the picture of the woman shooting a bullet through her breast, which has stuck with me forever and can't tell you how much problems it has caused. But Tommy's work obviously has influenced many people. I see people in this room today who used to tell me how much they got from Tommy and how much they wished they were Tommy. It's crazy that this is the first show of its kind. He has been such an important figure in American graphic humor, graphic commentary, art in general, and satire. And it is just a joy to be here with him. And I'm going to ask a few questions that have been on my mind. We haven't rehearsed. Then I'm going to open it up to you, or if anybody feels the urge, the irrepressible urge to make themselves known, please feel free. You won't insult me. So it's been a while.
Yes, I just would like to interfere, but you know that for different reasons I've been in a way kind of in exile from this country. One could call it banned if you think that all my books, even children's books, were forbidden in American libraries, that I was in the customs black book as unwanted, which would made it very difficult for me to come back here. But I must say that through all those years, Steve Heller has been a very faithful friend and in a way represented me here in America. So I want him to thank him very specially for his faithful abilities. Thank you.
It didn't take much effort, believe me. Tommy's work was all over the street and magazines in the 60s, his advertising campaigns for the Village Voice, for the New York Times. So why was it that you were banned?
Well, I always wondered that. Actually, it started, I think, let's not forget, you know, you cannot condemn a country or a country's people for its regime or for its president, but these were the McCarthyers and the witch hunt. And actually, I might just as well tell the story. De Gaulle, General De Gaulle, the President De Gaulle in France, was the first one to recognize Red China as a state. And me being I'm a French citizen, I went to, in accordance with Newsweek. Newsweek was going to send me to China to make a reportage. And so I went to Paris, and before, thanks be to God, I got my visa. There was a telex from the State Department stating that if I went to China, I would never be allowed back to the United States. So I gave up my trip and I came back. It was Idlewild Airport in those days. I went through customs, and I was in the middle of the hall, and then this was just like a scenario out of a movie. There was one man on my right, one on my left, one in my back. Really, it's a caricature of these kind of guys, you know, with kind of the hat, like
fedoras
this,
and
the same suit. And one says in my ear, drop your suitcases and follow us quietly. So I dropped the two suitcases. The guy behind grabbed them, and then immediately the other ones grabbed me on the arm and schlepped me into a car. It was already dark. I don't know where they took me. I was brought into a white room with a lamp in the thing, had to undress. They even opened up the soles of my shoes because they were looking for hidden messages or something like that. And then after that, it must have been like 62 and 63. And after that, my telephone was tapped. That stopped after the elections of Kennedy. But ever since then, I remained in the customs book of unwanted people.
What other kind of work were you doing
and,
at that time?
And not only this, at the time, I was playing poker with the Cuban ambassador to the United Nations, and all that. So that made me sinful and suspicious.
Were you doing other work at that time? That
oh yes, I was. I think I was already in my Vietnam posters, and I don't know. You know, I've never had a great sense of time. For me, time is timeless. You know, a second can take the shape of an hour or whatever. And as you noticed, I've never put a date on any drawings, and I never put a date on any letters, only on checkbooks. not checkbooks, on checks, you know, or official documents.
That's but still, at the time
at
you
the
came,
time,
you at the time you came to the United States,
you
were looking around for work.
Oh yeah, I came with a big trunk. You know, I joined the army originally, and in the army I had this big canteen in French, which is those metal trunks, mm-hmm. and that was full with drawings and books and ideas for books and even manuscripts as well that I came over with.
So how did you catch on? So it seemed to be very quick.
Yeah, it was very, very fast. I had no money. I had no money, but a girlfriend. But in those days. You know, you were not allowed to live in with a concubine, and her name was Nancy White, and I was Mr. White. Mr. White. It's very funny because I had two other girlfriends before, American ones, and one was called Black and the other one Gray. So it's absolute truth.
50
no,
Shades.
No, the one Black was a family name, and Gray was the other one. So. Anyway, I ended up with a white one, and the moment I arrived, I came off a cargo, a Norwegian cargo boat, and the next morning I was already out there. My first step was going to the newspaper kiosk and look at all the papers I would like to work with and just write down the telephone number and the name of the art director. And I wrote this down, and my office was, like for many other people, was a telephone cabin. Uh-huh. Because I lived in a basement, there was no telephone.
And who did you go to first?
Oh, I can't quite remember, but everybody was so absolutely incredibly nice, beyond. The first they would tell me, no, this is too European, but this and that advised me, this you can sell in America. And immediately they would take the phone and say, listen, like Jerry Snyder at Sports Illustrated says, we see, oh, you've got to see Harry Gordon and Columbia. And everybody, or see, go and see Leo Leoni, or go and see Henry Wolfe and his choir. Everybody was like that. And I wanted to do children's books, and the children's books in those days were ghastly. But the biggest outfit was Golden Books. Do they still exist?
I still read them.
Yeah, well, some of them are all right. You know, I thought this was the utmost. And I came to the editor there, and he said, listen, what you're showing me here is not publishable in America, but there's only one person who would, oh, hello. There's only one person who would publish you, and that is Ursula Nordstrom at Harvard.
Maurice Sendak, as well.
And that's when I met Maurice Sendak. We were embarked in the same boat like an Ark of Noah for illustrators. and my ascent was really fast. So Ursula told me that the book I had was the Melops, you know, but it was a horrible story with the butcher that locked them up and all this. But she said, why don't you do another story? Why don't you write another story with the same characters? Mm. And this is what I did, and I was lucky. Within a year, I had the first book came out, and it was on a book at the Spring Book Festival, and the second one was Cryptora, but a snake.
Well, let me ask you about Cryptora, because I have a story that you may not have heard. Fritz Eichenberg, who was an amazing wood engraver, illustrator, who loved your work, he was on the jury of the New York Times Best Books when Crichter came before him, and the other jurors threw it out because it had a snake as its main character. And he brought it back, and he said, snakes are as equal as any other characters.
Exactly.
And it won one of the 10 best books that year.
Yeah. And the Herald Tribune Prize. And but anyway, this was my whole point. You know, I'm Alsatian, and you know, I lived with the fact that the French collaborated with the Germans like we Alsatians never did. And with my accent after the war, I was literally ostracized as a Saal Bosch. So I know how it feels to be different. And I must say that all the children's books I did about after that were all actually ostracized animals, you know. I did one about the rats, about a chauve-souris, a bat, about a vulture, there we are, you know. It's only the other batch of other children books later which became really blandly political or historical, like Otto is about the Shoah.
Everything is about making a point? Everything is about looking at what the taboo is?
I don't know. Sometimes I'm conscious. I must say, in the last children books I did over the last 20 years, I wanted to make the point. Like in Making Friends is a story of a little black boy that comes in a white neighborhood. Now, I knew I wanted to do that. And with the Otto, I really realized there's no book about the Shoah and about the war. Everybody says, no, you can't show this to children. So I showed the war, I witnessed this, I saw the war, I saw everything I have in there. I mean, I know what it is to be in the last bridgehead of the Germans across the Rhine and being in the middle of a battle for 3 months without electricity, without water, and all that. And I know what it is to be called to the Gestapo and all that stuff. So.
And you saved many of those drawings that are right
yes,
over there.
Yes, exactly. So. Those are the drawings. I must say that already very early, I mean, my path, which turned into a highway, was traced.
Also,
which was definitely already young. I couldn't stand injustice or persecution or violence or all that stuff.
It raises an issue that I always wanted to ask you, because you did a cover for Monocle magazine, Black Power, White Power, which is also one of the posters in the poster series.
Yeah.
And a white man is eating a black leg, and a black man is eating the white man's leg. I could never figure out whether you were on any side or not.
Well, you know, a lot of my drawings are cryptical and can be interpreted in many ways. But this is, in a way, if my version, if you wanted to explain my version, might have a different one, is that the two races are equal, and they're that equal that we will eat each other forever, because there's always will be strife. Let's not have illusions about humanity. We can only survive because of exceptions.
Mm-hmm. So how did people respond to you over your political work? It was very raw, and of course we're at a time when...
Yeah, we're out of Vietnam and all that, and please, people don't realize that I've been keeping on this rhythm all along when I was back in Europe. I kept on doing posters. I've always been engaged on all my life.
Those posters were done on your own, right?
Yes. No, it was, you know, what was the group that started, you know, Graphics for Peace?
Oh, SANE.
Yes, sane.
Right.
They asked me to do, and they rejected it. So I decided I would print them at my own cost, and I was befriended with Richard Kasach, who had a series of postal shops, and that's how they then spread like mad.
Right.
And but I must say, one must not forget that in those early 60s, late 50s, and all that, there was the United States and New York. And New York was kind of a town, like a fortress of refugees, that anybody who felt that he had to say something or state something or fight for something, they all came to New York. So of course in New York I was extremely welcome, and it went on very well. But as I said in the piece I just wrote in the catalog, you know, I arrived here as an immigrant, welcomed by the Statue of Liberty, and realized only later on that the Statue of Liberty is turning its back on America. not absolutely, not always, not in a drastic way, but you know, everything has its other sides.
Right. Well, you did something in relation.
It is with me and my work generally. It's really always both sides now.
Right. You did something in response to the Charlie Hebdo.
Yes, I
shootings.
I did this drawing just before I arrived, and I didn't do this because a lot of my posters were conceived with anger. But I did this shooting of Charlie Hebdo with an incredible sense of sadness, really. Sadness for what happened, but as well of why it happened.
Why do you think it happened?
Well, that's exactly why we have to atone. Excuse me, there's no terrorism without roots. And it's most likely too late now, but I think in France there is a very strong racist current. And this is where it's ending now. And I do personally think that we are now at the beginning of a third world war. The first world war was in the trenches. You might say the second world war was in the air, and the third one is electronic and underground. It's pure frustrations.
What was your sense when you heard the news? I mean, Charlie Hebdo.
It made me sick. It made me sick because they called from several papers, called me, you know. And I couldn't even formulate. It's actually only today that I really am. You know, I just couldn't sort it out. I couldn't sort it out.
What about in relation to your own work? I mean, you've done some very raw pieces over the years, and you've taken shots at folly and hypocrisy. But have you ever felt threatened the way?
Oh well, I have been, for heaven's sake. When I moved from Canada, after I left New York, we went to Canada, went to Ireland, and I've always been very involved in the French-German reunification and peace, which is a phenomenon that in the whole of world history has never happened, that two nations that have been really at each other's throat at the price of millions and millions of people have become to collaborate and work in friendly terms, and I've dedicated a lot into this project. And in those days it was anathema. I got death menace letters from French patriots saying, you come back, tu reviens en France, on va te descendre, you come back to France, we'll mow you down.
So it was as if you were still a child in Alsace.
Yeah, so again, and I am Alsatian, you see. I mean, I always say I'm Alsatian, but with Europe, what does it matter if you are French or German? And Europe would not exist if it hadn't been for France and German reciprocity of this. And you know, I mean, one must forgive but not forget, of course.
How do you feel cartoonists should act now that? I mean, the credible threats have been there for
years. It's not only cartoonists. I think it's especially in the children's books that we need more children's books. Like I was saying, you know, I've been very busy in France, kind of culturally, politically. I've been what you would call an advisor, chargé de mission, at the Ministry of Education and at the Ministry of Culture. And I had set up a whole commission there to teach children already in kindergarten respect. You know, to teach respect of elderly people, of food, even money, of religion, and with some basic books. And we had a whole list of subjects like this, of teaching respect through books. And we had already authors lined up to bring up that special series. And but then there were elections, and my boss, Jacques Lang, the Minister de l'Éducation Nationale, well, in France, it's not, I don't know how it is in America, but in France, when you have the election, one minister has 3 days to move out his office. They don't sit down with the new minister to discuss, hey, we invest. We had already television spots about respect for children. And all that was stopped because everything the guy did before did is no good. And, you know, there's a point where, you know, but anyway, that was my plan and it was underway. And as I said, for instance, my book Otto would have been as an example of that, showing children what is war. And I had a book about hunger, a book about thirst, about all the major things that children should know about, because this is reality. If it's in the newspapers, it should be in children's books.
How is Otto embraced in France?
Oh, very well, everywhere, very well.
So there has, from a popular point of view, there hasn't been resistance to
here. Now, you know, the book that hasn't come out here about my Nazi childhood, that's used in France in the history
you
course.
You mean Tommy?
Yeah.
That has
that's
come out.
À la guerre comme à la guerre. That's used as a school book in history. And the book Otto is part of for younger people, is part of the school, is part of the school teaching for the Shoah and so
right.
on. Yeah.
So it's
not that it's just a book that you have in the library, it is used the way it should, the books like this should be used.
So it must pain you what's going on right now. The whole idea that Jews will leave France behind because of what's going on.
Well, on the whole line. Whether the whole situation now, it's like with everything, we've reached a point where nothing can be repaired anymore. We cannot change the climate situation.
Did you believe you could change the climate when you started out?
No. Already, I mean, I've been involved there as well. And I've been active in many things. I mean, I did a book called Amnesty Animal, and I know I'm bragging, but I was honorary president in from the European, or you call it SPCA?
SPCA, ASPCA.
Yeah, for the animal, you know, these kind of things. So
it's okay, you can brag.
No. But I've been involved as much for animals as for nature, as for ecology and all that. Like my book, The Black Book, was only about ecology and so on.
You also did a book that is really quite human. I mean, all of them are, but this one touched me greatly. When you moved up to Nova Scotia, you talked about the whole process.
Oh, well, this is
of
part
farming.
Of my autobiography books,
right.
Because I especially now, I write as much as I draw. I mean, really, actually, my profession is awful, which means I draw what I draw what I don't write, and I write what I draw.
And the writing has been consistent. With
yes,
your
yes,
career,
yes,
but only.
But not published in English, because I'm trilingual. You see, being Alsatian, French, German, and then English. You have English in the pocket.
And you said Yiddish.
Yes, because Yiddish comes from Alsatian. So if you speak Alsatian, for instance, in Strasbourg, we have the only Jewish radio in Europe, Radio Judaica, and. I had interviews, you know, like Yiddish and Yiddish and Alsatian. So it's just a step because if from so don't forget the Rhine was one of the main mercantile really arteries in Europe and it's Alemannic dialect and this is what then came and spread. But I will tell you, I'll have much greater difficulties with Russian or the Polish Yiddish. This is more difficult. But I published a book in Yiddish and German and with illustrations of the Warsaw Ghetto.
It seems as though you've published about almost everything, including one of my favorites, which you may want to hide from, Defers.
The what?
The fart.
Oh, yeah, that was, oh, no, I didn't write that. It was a collection. I illustrated, really, you know, but it's gone with the wind.
You know, I used to spend time looking into your studio. It's good. I used to spend time looking into your studio from the Times.
Oh, that was incredible.
42nd Street.
Oh, my goodness.
Can you describe your studio to these people?
Well, I mean, it's my life is always full of hazards. I always, you know, like the one place we landed in Canada, my wife and I, that was the one place where they had closed up the police station. I mean, you'll read all this if you... This is republished in English. It's now far out. Is not far enough. Well, I described my life there. You know, which it was like the Far West. You live by the gun. Well, why do I have to land just at the one place where there's no, you know, no police? And this lovely young man, the neighbor over the hill who came and arrived there, brought me a salmon, and soon afterwards, well, he had several brothers, and he shot one with 5 bullets. And I asked him, Herman, why did you do it? And he said, you know, once a year, you've got to shoot it out. You know, so you land up in a situation like this, and tell me why, just looking for a studio, I shouldn't end up on 42nd Street, my favorite neighborhood anyway, at the time, not now, with all this illumination. It's like Hamburg or Berlin during the war, during the bombings, with all the lights and everything. And that was a wood-paneled studio with an incredible terrace and mullioned windows, and it used to be the office of Florence Ziegfeld from the Ziegfeld Follies.
Any remnants?
No. But I kept my own follies.
I know you had a hammock where you...
Yes, on the porch. I had. Oh, you remember that?
Well, I could see it from where I was looking in with the binoculars.
Oh, yeah. Were you with God?
I was with him, yes. We both sanctioned what you were doing.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
So, yeah. A lot has happened in your life. Has anything changed in terms of your attitudes from when you were young to now that is a profound change in your point of view?
Well, quite a long time ago, there's one element I was able to eliminate, is eliminate hate, and to hate, because I there were times where I was hateful.
Because you were also quite angry in those times.
Well, the anger, yes, and anger is my for me, is, you know, when I'm angry, I lose my marbles. I get out of control. That's really one of my worst aspects. On the other hand, don't forget something like this is fuel. Anger was fuel for my work. I mean, because it's really great for people like us, you know, to be able to express whether in writing or in drawing, to just get it out of the system,
Well, when I first
and
met
this
you,
was
I heard...
True. And for me, everything was always something to fight for, yeah, like for eroticism too. This is another thing I fought for.
Well, that's a very important point, because you got kicked out of the book area.
I was ahead of my time in those days with my erotic books, but the battle is over now. There's not a battle anymore. I don't know, you know Tashin, you know, they brought up a collection of all my erotic works. It's about two kilos, it's a big album like this. And in Europe, on signing sessions, sometimes there were more women than men, and I was delighted. it's a delighted.
When you were doing those erotic pieces, what I understand is that the children's book establishment was not too pleased.
No. I will give you an example and not say the name. But I would say some at the New York Times, you know, they have the book section every Sunday, and then they had a section for children's books. And the editor, and I remember it was maybe Moonman came out, And he refused to review it. He said, the guy who did the Fornicon has no rights to do children's books.
Was this George?
And No. And then my friend, a friend of ours, and I just learned that he died last year, J.C. Suarez. You remember the time I bought him a saber and he used to go through the offices and pull out his saber?
Yes,
he was at the New York, he terrified everybody at the New York Times. And it's J.C. Suarez, who was working too in the book section or whatever, who arranged for the Moon Man to be reviewed in the adult section. And the irony, it was one of the New York, and the irony is that an independent jury had chosen it as one of the New York Times 10 best of the year. So can you imagine a book that's the New York Times 10 best of the year, and the editor is refusing to review?
Well, that editor was very powerful, but also the librarians were very powerful.
Well, he was very powerful, I understand. He had 7 children.
It was George.
Not George Nicholson.
No, he had another name.
That was a great one. Another George.
He's dead too. But effectively, your career as a children's book illustrator, at least in the United States, was over.
Yes, and but you know, for me, I mean, everything I do has always been a sideline. You know, you cannot say just that I've been doing children's books and all that. In America, I would be more a children's book author because my other books have not been published, like Babylon and all. And so it's all relative. Now, I'm not putting it down, but still, I mean, right now, I mean, even the early books like the Melops are being translated in every possible language, and I still don't understand why, because I learned to draw as I went along, you know, and for me, books like this, especially the early books, are just a source of embarrassment.
So when you look around the walls here and you see this evolution, how do you feel?
Well, normally, if I have an exhibition like this, I feel very uncomfortable, because I've always been haunted by, you know, nothing is ever right. There are some exceptions, but Claire made such an incredible work, and I'm always so worried. You see, I went always hopscotching from one style to the other, from one challenge to the other, and an exhibition like this could look like a maze of mishaps, you know, and just going this and that. But Claire was, you know, she came to the museum in Strasbourg and she visited us in Ireland, and then with Aria, my daughter, who's been really my agent, Herman here, you know. And when I have an exhibition, I don't influence. I let people do it, for one thing. And I was completely surprised how actually with so many styles that it's there's a logic, you know. I have a feeling that she put my life in order.
There's a picture that you did that I ran in one of my books, Man Bites Man, and it was in a Diogenes portfolio, and it's all these fingers on a street, and the fingers become cones.
Oh yeah, that was in Babylon.
That was in Babylon, yeah, and it was just such a departure from your linear work, but very Daumier.
Yeah, well, that was influence. I really acknowledged my influences. And I always said that this book I was influenced by Daumier. And some of the drawings are really that big. And when I did Babylon, my point was I want to have a book with all the diseases and evils of society. So I must say there's everything from drugs, from ecology, the whole range is in there.
So how do you feel?
Religion too.
How do you feel all these years later, you know, being banned, losing the
well,
American market?
Banned is a bit exaggerated.
Well, being...
And not only this, I asked for it. I'm an agent provocateur, please. I enjoy it. I mean, and even in Europe, I had quite a few things which was really, I'm not even going to mention it. I mean, this is, that might be.
You'll tell me later?
No. But anyway, I never stopped being that way.
But now you have a museum dedicated to you. There's a wonderful film out, which, by the way, is screening on Monday night at the IFC Center. Tommy's going to be there taking questions from the director, Brad.
Brad Bernstein.
I don't think so. But get there quick to the box office.
Yeah.
And get a tattoo while you're waiting, because they're... So how do you feel about these what? Accolades?
The museum, well, look here, I'm very insecure, as you saw it, well, you know, with exhibitions and all that. And I love accolades, and I love to be decorated. Now, in Europe, I'm very heavily decorated, you know, but not so much, not because of my books, but because my cultural, political activism. You know, don't forget, Jacques Lang gave me carte blanche for all cultural initiatives between France and Germany.
Amazing.
And I didn't do this alone. I mean, all this political thing, I was, you know, you never do anything alone. You have always a team and people of working, and in this case with Robert Walter, who's running now the Franco-German Institute. Mm-hmm. And we really did a lot, you know. Really.
How did the museum come to be? You donated a lot of work to your hometown.
I think that would be the reason why, because I don't know. I gave the museum of something like 13,000 drawings in my library and to my hometown, and the museum was financed half by my hometown and half by the French government.
And you told me that...
But that is an engineer for you.
Right, but you told me there's an ongoing program there, that it's not
reliquary. Yeah, it's every 4 months there is another exhibition. So it's not a museum where you just go once. So every 4 months you have another... And in terms of decorating, you did a great job, and then we have a lot of guest artists. We had Steinberg, we had Bob Blackman, William Steig, and I have a wonderful curator. I'm surrounded with wonderful people. My curator is Thérèse Villers, and she knows every drawing by heart. I wouldn't know anything, and she takes all these initiatives, and it's very handy, because if somebody wants to organize an exhibition, like Claire will tell you, that she came to Strasbourg and talked it over to make a selection and all that. As I said, it's very easy actually to organize an exhibition. But now I have some new exhibitions coming out, like in the Museum of Modern Art in Zurich, and that's only about new works, and about my sculptures and all the collages I'm doing now.
Can you talk about your collages and your sculptures?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I think others do that better than I would. I'm just having fun. No, I must have my kicks. I have to express myself.
Well, in the movie, you were...
Well, there were no, the movie doesn't show
The movie
show
doesn't
many
have your
sculptures.
Current sculptures,
no,
but
no,
it has
it
your
doesn't.
Action figure obsession.
Well, yes, yeah, well... You remember some of my early, you know, already my Barbie dolls and machines. Well, I still make things with Barbie dolls, you know. I still do that.
I
found out one thing with Barbie dolls. You have to be very careful now, because many of them have AIDS.
I think on that note, we'll open it up to the audience. Are there any questions out there? Yes.
Oh, definitely. Now, I have a lot of influences. If you see my whole array of I think every artist has influences, you know, and I had a lot of influences. And, then you go on. I think the artist is... It's just like milestones on a big road of culture, and every artist is a funnel from so many influences, and then he leaves his own mark. But I would say that my mark is, for me, the style is not the question. For me, the question is to get an ID clearly on paper and stated. So for me, a drawing is most of the time not, you know, is an intellectual statement. And this is where Steinberg has been most likely the most influential, I would say, dessinateur, drawer. I don't like the word cartoonist. That his greatest influence consisted in showing that you can take a whole concept, even a philosophical concept or an opinion or something, and with the clarity of a few lines, you can just settle it there. So I would say if Steinberg was a great influence of mine, it was intellectually. It was intellectually. And I still think he's the greatest of the last century.
Of you're working in collage.
My admiration for Steinberg
knows no bounds.
No, absolutely not.
You're working in collage now.
Well, I always did, but now it's very funny. You know, I have drawers and drawers of things I cut out for use of collages and even for sculptures too. And a lot of things is things that I already brought with me via Canada from New York, as if I knew that someday I would just need that element. And it's very funny, like I do sculptures, objects, with some things you'd say, why would it travel and carry that stuff, this garbage, really? Because I love garbage, I love leftovers. Even in food, I think with leftovers you do the best meals. And as I said, you know, I must say that this is really a show of leftovers here. I as a person, I'm the leftover of my leftovers.
Any other questions? Yes, over here.
Oh yeah, well, obscured even, yes. Oh yeah, I still occasionally, you know, I I'm a bit like the Minotaur. I need a few sacrifices every year. But I must say my greatest joy and pleasure is when I'm being given a Barbie doll and just rip off the clothes. You know, and all of that, there she is, naked like a sardine.
Do you have a specific recipe for it?
No, I think in the pan is still about the best.
Thanks for the question.
Yes.
Anyone else? Yes, all the way. Yellow.
Could you be a little bit louder? Pardon. We're a little bit back again to the unwanted animal, you know. I mean, in my variant of Little Red Riding Hood, she meets the wolf who's very rich and says, please come in my castle. And her grandmother's a nasty friggin' bitch, you know. So she decides to elope with the wolf. and the grandmother starves since she's not coming every. And I kind of used my last of the last book, which called Yvonne. What was my last? My wife is here. Excuse me. You know, with a little girl on the Vespa area. Zloty. It happens in Poland. Is the equivalent of a modern Red Riding Hood, and that is, I think, for me the most important children's books I've done, because it's about total relativity. She meets, she doesn't meet the wolf. Yeah, the wolf is still there, but first she meets a dwarf, and she meets a giant. She's on a Vespa, on a scooter, and she has an accident, And she meets a dwarf and a giant. And this is a tall dwarf and a small giant, and both are the same size. So she's in pure relativity. And then they fix up the waistband. Then on the way to her grandmother, she runs over the wolf. And she takes the poor wolf, who's really wounded and hurt. And there's no space. He has to go lie down. So he's in bed with the grandmother, you see. But, whatever. But I put the whole concept of relativity, you see, in this. Because what is great is small. It's all relative, you know. If you are an ant in front of a puddle, you're in front of a sea. And if you have an elephant above, the gray sky is an elephant. It's not the sky. So everything is relative.
You know what's amazing is you've described this book, and you don't need the pictures.
What?
You would have been great on radio serials.
Well, possibly. Yes, with a little bit of help from my friends.
Other questions? Yes, all the way back there.
First, I always talk to children and animals as equals. I always think that the children should be talked at as grown-ups, and we have a lot of learn from children, because their interpretation of reality is sometimes much clearer. It hasn't been veiled yet with too much knowledge, and they do not pretend to be right or teach you anything. And the greatest quality of children is they are curious, and this is what's a wonderful thing. And now, I have to tell you, you know, there's a French magazine, and in Germany, it's the same magazine in two languages, which is called Philosophy Magazine. And there, every month, I answer children's questions. And I can tell you that if I enjoy doing it, it's because those children's questions know, you know, are much better than adult questions. And they are really... that much more so direct and so much more basic, you know. So
I take that basic. Personally.
Yeah. And so, well, no, that would about, well, I would have a lot more to say about that. And as I said, you'll see that in all my children's books, there's always an element of scariness. Because I think children should be taught to overcome fear.
Is there a book you're working on? Right?
Like the other day, a lady came to visit me in my studio with a six-year-old child, and I have a skeleton in my studio. So I told this little girl and told her to go and shake hands with my mother. And then I told her that it was a skeleton. And you know, with children, you have to tell them it's a joke after that. But this is a way for a child to surmount her fear of death or skeletons.
You have those books that didn't come out on food and the like. Do you have something that you're working on right now that is...
Well, this is always, you know, in my drawers I would have about 10 stories or whatever, children's books. But there's one I want to do, exactly, it's a good question, because there's one that's called Skelly, which comes from skeleton. And this is a book that I would like to come out with to familiarize children with death. It's a guy who's an undertaker, among all things, and he's in the cemetery. He died a while ago. And one night he gets out of his tomb because he finds it so boring, so he goes back home, you know. And his wife is asleep, and he pinches her nose and says, "It's me, darling." And she sees the skeleton. She, of course, she doesn't recognize him and all that. And all that, so now he becomes very popular, especially he gives a whole boost to his business. Can you imagine an undertaker who's a skeleton? There's nothing more reassuring than that. And I couldn't have an end. So I was discussing it with a friend of mine. We came up with the idea. I think it was Herman. because I had a horrible ending for the canned youth. It was a terrorist coming in a school ready to blow it up. And he goes in there, and of course the terrorist couldn't shoot him because the bullets go right through his skeleton. But that's, I cannot do that in a children's book. So I came up with a solution that his wife is very seriously ill. She dies, his wife, because he missed his wife when he died, like I would, because my wife was here. So his wife dies, and what does he do? He decides now, you know, his wife is in a homemade coffin. I'm not homemade, but I mean, in a big coffin. And then this is a coffin is a little bit bigger than the other ones because it's got a double floor. And he puts himself under his wife so that he can be buried forever and stay with her forever. This is really, I've got tears in my eyes.
So it raises a question about children's book publishing today. A lot of your children's books are, as you said with Frichter, an adult book, or can be read and appreciated by adults. You're being published by Fiden in the United States.
Yes, now this is what changed my life. In a way. Because as I told you, I hadn't been published, and nobody would touch me. I was like, with all the languages I'm translated, I was not in English, because England was, it's the same thing. It's an American suburb. London is an American suburb. And not only this, I had a big exhibition in London about 20 years ago. You remember the one from the Art Décoratif? Mm-hmm. Went to London at the Royal Festival Hall, and there was a huge thing, women movement, and they sprayed, and they had to take down one third of the exhibition, and I was there again, literally banned in England. And then came Fiden, and then for the last 4 or 5 years they've been printing about 3-4 titles a year to catch up with time, which is an incredible thing.
Are they printing new titles as well as the old?
Yeah, I don't know really what I forget. I don't know. Well, Otto was rather, as I did Otto, Otto was rather new. No, I was very pleased that he did my Canada book. You know, far out is not far enough. So I'm really a spoiled brat. I mean, really, all my life I always say I'd rather deal with a barricade than with a traffic jam, you know. And then it seems for all these causes I fought, like in France and Germany, I'm decorated instead of being in jail. You know, it's just not bad.
One more question, yes.
If I would share what?
Your fears.
My fears.
And favorite things.
Oh, you know, fears come and go, and favorite things too. I mean, it's everything is relative. I couldn't. It would be like a shopping list, and it would vary all the time. I mean, you know, if I look at which way the world is going now, ecologically, in every way. Of course I fear for the world, but is it fear? Or is it anxiety? You know, it's very difficult to define fear or define anxiety, because it's tied up with so many other elements. So I don't have a favorite fear. Thank you.
So I think we're going to take about a 15-minute break, give Tommy a little moment. appreciate it. Perhaps if you can step outside so that we can get the chairs out of here, and then to try and form a line.
No. I just want to say that I have only limited energy at my age, please. So I'm not going to dedicate with your name or anything. I'm just going to give you a nice calligraphy signature, and somebody going to use my rubber stamp. And on this rubber stamp is one of my sayings, which says, don't hope, cope. So you will have something on your page.
Yes. Well, I'm ready.